Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast. I would just like to give you this shocking revelation right now. Did you know that Roger Ebert sometimes has an oat-sized reaction to a movie? I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanagieser. And what's the deal with podcasting? You're not throwing anything out anywhere. Dave,
yes.
It's going to be one of those episodes. Tell the good people at home, what's it going to be an episode of?
Well, yes, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The only thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, what are we taking a look at on this episode, the last regular episode of 2021?
We are taking a look, coming from Ang Lee's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, a somber film that is also actually very funny in its own absurd way. We are following actress Deirdre Lovejoy to 1998, a film that was certainly meant to be funny and remembered as not. We are looking at 1998's Sour Grapes, probably most operatively known as a film written and directed by one Larry David. Yes, of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, as well as Whatever Works, the Woody Allen one, and the Farrelly Brothers' Three Stooges, which also has Craig Bierko, as does this film. That's right, Steven Weber, Craig Bierko, the comedic stylings collide on screen, as well as Viola Harris, Jennifer Lee Warren, Orlando Jones, Philip Baker Hall, and Tucker Smallwood.
Yes, yes. So this is the second time Tucker Smallwood's here. Sadly, he doesn't get any dialogue in tonight's film, but don't forget, you can still check out that episode of Millennium where he sings Seasons in the Sun while helping people commit assisted suicide. I'm going to remind you folks that that's a thing out there. Any chance I get. But yeah, before we jump into or get to our usual shtick here in the episode, Andrew, I mean, I think it's fair to say we should probably open up with the big, big question here. What do you think of Seinfeld?
Oh, I thought it was going to be, why do bad things happen to good people? Seinfeld. Ba-da-ba-ba-bow. I mean, like, what do you say about it? Like, I think there are a lot of people who have a lot of takes on it. I have not seen a lot of Seinfeld. I don't overly care for it, if I'm honest. But I think what a lot of people overlook is that your personal opinion of it cannot erase the fact that it is a significant television show, a significant cultural object, and I think without hyperbole, certainly one of the biggest TV shows of the 1990s, and maybe one of the biggest TV shows of all time.
Well, yeah, and certainly of the sort of pre-streaming, pre-divisive audience, like this is sort of like the height of sort of mainstream television in terms of sort of like the last golden era for the networks here.
Well, yeah, we're talking. And I mean, you look at the just reading recently that It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is soon to break the record of longest airing live action sitcom. And in a lot of ways, though, I think you can trace a show like that and sort of the, what is it that they said about Seinfeld? No learning, no hugging. Like that kind of comedy becoming mainstream popular. It all begins with a show about nothing. Dave, what's your take on Seinfeld?
I am a casual fan. Like, this is a show I, like, let's understand. My mother loved the show when I was growing up, during its original airing. My brother, younger brother, is a huge Seinfeld fan. Granted, my younger brother is also a huge fan of classic sitcoms in general. He doesn't buy much in the way of DVDs, but the entire run of Cheers is part of that collection, and so is the run of Seinfeld as well. So,
well, I mean, I've got the Columbo and Rockford Files set, so who am I to judge? You know,
understood. But I mean, I enjoy it, and there are things that like I wasn't a hardcore invested. This wasn't like, you know, Star Trek for me, where I was, you know, deeply invested in it. But I mean, part of it is the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of sort of iconic dark comedy moments that I remember of me and Eric were discussing the infamous envelope climax to the engagement of George Costanza episode, in which his fiance dies by licking a bunch of super cheap envelopes for their wedding invitations because George decided to skimp on the quality of the material.
It you realize was... that that's twice in the opening that you've talked about people dying.
Yes,
you know, in a sense, licking an envelope fatally is a form of assisted suicide. You know, much like listeners may be contemplating, because the central question remains, what on earth is sour grapes and why are we talking about Seinfeld? So for even the diehard Seinfeld fans, though, I think there's a genuine argument to be made that they have no idea what this movie is. Is that fair?
I think most people have forgotten it, to say the least, if they were aware of it at all.
And if you ask Larry David, apparently he would like to forget it. So all the more reason that we give ourselves a refresher by throwing to Dave, who will do what he does best, and give us the rundown.
Sour Grapes is the 1998 comedy written and directed by Larry David. Starring Steven Weber and Craig Bierko, the film follows two cousins who come into conflict after one wins on an Atlantic City slot machine after borrowing two quarters from the other. What starts off as a battle over the principle of who's owed what quickly escalates with a false diagnosis, an attempted murder, a botched medical procedure performed on a sitcom star, and the gradual destruction of a rental property. A critical and commercial disaster, Sour Grapes would go on to be the only film directed by David, with the film even becoming a punchline in David's far more successful television project, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Coming up after film strips, Dennis DeYoung performs AD 1958 on a rerun of The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, so anyway, I can't believe it. Nobody liked the movie, Seinfeld. I guess as we were getting into it, though, it's very difficult to talk about the movie Sour Grapes, or why anyone would talk about it, separate from the TV show Seinfeld. We'll tie it all together in a moment, but for those of you who don't know, Seinfeld is why Jerry Seinfeld is, like, world-renowned. It is a TV series that ran on NBC 89 to 1998, the same year that this one comes out. And it's a very different kind of show than I think a lot of, like, domestic sitcoms. Like, Friends, maybe, as a counterpoint, is more sweet-natured and light, whereas Seinfeld... how do I put it, without sounding like dismissive or blunt about it, but like, I think it's fair to say it's also a show typified by a very Jewish style of humor, or like, it's a show that is like unabashedly working on what we understand like American Jewish humor to be. And I think that's also something that sets it apart and gives it a very different comic sensibility than other shows airing at the time. Does that make sense?
It does, and I would say very specifically, it's also a very New York perspective as well. And that's... and I think this,
like,
is the
same
thing
way Woody Allen, his comic writing sensibility speaks to that same, like, tradition. The same way that some people do, like, a vaudeville tradition, right? Just, like, meaning that as a very type of humor, which is often about, you know, instead of physical comedy or prop comedy, it's derived from characters largely arguing with one another over meaningless things to the point of absurdity.
Well, and this is the thing. So to sort of quickly run through the big key points everybody needs to know, there are two individuals who are really behind the launching of Seinfeld. One is Jerry Seinfeld, who had sort of started, who started as a stand-up comedian, built his name, sort of doing what it would be sort of at the foundational level of observational humor.
Yeah. The shorthand Seinfeld is, what's the deal with, and then usually some kind of wordplay, right? Like Ovaltine, why is it in a round jar? Or, you know, what's the deal with 2% milk? What's the other 98 you're getting, you know?
Yeah, and then the other figure is Larry David. Now, David, I would say, was probably because he wasn't on the show was for a long time the less visible individual.
Yeah, like the silent partner.
In some ways, but he had come out, again, he was a comedy writer. He had very briefly worked on Saturday Night Live, where during the post-Lorne Michaels, but before Michaels' return era, where my understanding was he worked for an entire year. I think it was during the same season Julia Louis-Dreyfus was there, and proceeded not to get a single sketch on air at the time. There, I think that was the sort of noted thing where it's like, yeah, you saw his name every credits, never saw a single thing he actually wrote make it to air. But yeah,
It's like how the Genius got signed by WCW Wrestling in its dying days, and they paid him a contract for 2 years, never used him on TV once, or even called him to work a show. He literally got sat home and got paid TBS money.
All right, then. Hopefully TBS money was good. I can't actually say.
This was before the merger. I don't know. It was a different time. But, I mean, I think it's also important to understand, though, that kind of what ends up happening with Seinfeld. Like, its whole trajectory and popularity, as you sort of nodded to off the top, is very much of the time of broadcast television. Right, like, I think if you compared, like, number of viewers or number of download equivalents, Seinfeld would seem kind of minor, but, like, when everybody is cabled in, I think it's safe to say that it ended up becoming, innocuously enough, like, one of the biggest shows of its era.
Well, and this is the thing, and I think what's important to put it in context here is when we're thinking about sort of the biggest sitcoms of the in the decades that had led up towards Seinfeld, and even during the era of Seinfeld, a lot of them were very much, you know, we had workplace sitcoms, we had these sort of family sitcoms, we had, and when we started talking about sitcoms that sort of dealt with quote-unquote darker subject matter, typically what we would talk about were things like All in the Family or MASH, where suddenly, yeah, they're comedies about, you know, not necessarily idealized figures, but when things got serious, they got serious.
Well, even,
you know,
Saved by the Bell had very special episodes, right? Like, the idea of the serious episode is itself kind of a trope of this style of TV.
Well, exactly. And ultimately, when Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld come together to create this show, they pitch it as the show about nothing, and which in truth is sort of disingenuous, because it basically ends up being about anything and everything but what your typical sitcom shtick is, in the sense that what we're dealing with is what will ultimately turn out to be four, after the original pilot, in which it was just three central characters, who are just, you know, they're friends. They live in New York, in the same general community. They talk with each other daily. And basically, to greater or lesser extents, they are petty, oblivious, or in some cases, just, you know, extremely selfish. I mean, they were not necessarily meant to be...
They're not, like, lovable, right? They're not the cast of Friends, where, you know, Chandler is a prick, but, you know, he's a nice guy underneath. Whereas, like, part of what sets Seinfeld apart is that they have no problem making their central characters unsympathetic.
Well, and that's exactly it. Like, this is basically these people versus the world. Now, that's not to say that they weren't relatable, and I think that's the big distinction. Yeah. Whereas, yes, they're not necessarily likable, but everybody knows somebody, or everybody's been involved in a situation where pettiness got in the way, or you stood your ground on ridiculous issues, or, you know, social custom really became the battleground over something, which just exploded into something bigger than you would think. And
well,
that,
yeah,
really,
and
I think,
it's I mean, it's also a show that structurally, more often than not, is that from, like, the opening, you end up getting two branches of the story that both spiral off in very absurd directions, but then also tie together at the end in an unexpected way. So, again, the idea that it's the show about nothing, that kind of makes you think, like, it's not a show about anything and everything in the same sense that, like, the lol random kind of humor is. Like, it's a show that's predicated on absurdity, but there's a structure to doing absurdity, as opposed to throw anything at the wall.
Well, exactly. And more to the point, it was a show done without any sense of sentimentality. Like, you will never get the Seinfeld episode that was the very special episode. There was never going to be the one where we discover that Kramer's been taking heroin the entire time, and they got to get him clean. Like, that wasn't the thing. Like, even things where you would think, like, you know, again, one of the things was Seinfeld was also willing to touch things that might seem a little taboo or off weird. And I like, there are episodes such as, there was the one during when Schindler's List came out where they did a whole episode about Jerry making out with his girlfriend during the screenings of that, and just how absolutely disrespectful that was. And it's just like, who in their right mind would make it that as a basis for an episode of television? And yet, or yes, I mean, again, like, just the level, an entire season, which basically is about the origins of the show Seinfeld, yeah, by covering Jerry and George's efforts to write this script that keeps going completely wrong during the course of it. And the thing is, you don't root for them to succeed. You're not really necessarily rooting for them to fail either. You just know that ultimately they will fail, because that's the way it works for these people.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's, and I mean, that's sort of the thing where it's not necessarily topical, but it is very uniquely cultural, in ways that, like, Friends is set in New York, but, I mean, there's, I think, maybe something a bit more universal about it. Apparently, as I understand, like, Seinfeld is much less popular in non-English-speaking nations because it's very cultural and it's also very linguistic in a lot of its humor, and, like, certainly its delivery and, like, the payoff of actual jokes. Like, Michael Richards as Kramer, you know, certainly does a lot of physicality to his comedy, but it's primarily, like, a dialogue-driven humor. And within that writing, though, as you said, it's very New York, and it's very of its time. All of that to signal, though, that it certainly captures the zeitgeist, and I think after it went off air, I mean, like, TV Guide, which, remember that, kids, at one point had it as the greatest TV show of all time. The thing is, though, every TV show eventually needs to end. And in 1998, Seinfeld came to an end. And I remember being a kid and not really being, like, knowing what Seinfeld was, but never seeing it or watching it. Even then, as a kid, I remember so many people around me getting excited for the Seinfeld finale, and an almost, not sense of disappointment, but almost Krusty the Clown with the cigarette looking blankly and saying, "What the hell was that?" It's an ending episode that's famously sort of unexpected, and doesn't provide the closure that you think it will be. In that way, it inspired Neon Genesis Evangelion. but, you know, it's one of those things where it's almost like The Sopranos, where you're kind of stuck with, when you have a show that's as meteorically popular as it is, it does need to end. How do you end it in a satisfying way? And then, once a show like that comes to a close, what do you do next?
Well, and here's the thing. It's a little more complicated than even that, because the thing is, Larry David left Seinfeld before it was done. Larry David left, I believe, two or three seasons before the show would come to an end, because he sort of felt that he had come to do whatever he could. He would come back to write that final episode.
Yes.
There, but otherwise he left, and you can basically tell the point at which he does, because every episode after he left, Jerry's for the early seasons, you would always intercut with Seinfeld's comedy routines there. And after he left, that basically disappeared, and all the comedy routine stuff was jettisoned, from the sounds of it, mostly because Seinfeld had to pick up more slack on his end, overseeing the writer's room, that it just did not leave the time to sort of write out gags and that and work for the episode. But with that, you know, the thing is that Seinfeld was produced by Castle Rock Entertainment, a production company named after, yes, Stephen King's fictional little town in Maine, which is, again, usually a place where terrible things happen. But
and to our American listeners, happy Thanksgiving. Go look up that tweet if you think I'm lying. It's fun what people constitute as helpful. Yeah, Castle
Yes.
Rock, though. Is it Rob Reiner who started that?
I believe it is Rob Reiner, because he would go on to do Misery and ultimately, I believe, or
Dolores
The Body.
Claiborne?
I think he produced... I think he was a producer on Dolores Claiborne. He definitely directed Misery, and he directed Stand By Me, the adaptation of The Body, prior to that. But he had a really good working relationship with Stephen King. Really, you know, those were amongst the high points of his career. So he ended up naming the production company after that. And the big point is, you know, Seinfeld was produced through
that was
them.
Directed by Taylor Hackford, friend of the show.
Yes, White Knights himself. But yeah, oh, and the Devil's Advocate. I guess that means we have to get there at some point. But the point
I'm
being
just gonna
is
do that
that
for the rest of the episode.
Yeah. Now the point is that David leaves, but as best as I can find, and as the reason I say as best as I can find, because there doesn't seem to be much in the way of any production history you can find on Sour Grapes. Basically, Castle Rock seems to have wanted to keep Larry David close to home and make sure it's like, okay, fine, he's leaving, but that doesn't mean we can't keep working with him. I mean, we can keep building a really good relationship with him, right? And it seems that Sour Grapes basically became the production that existed basically to keep Larry David around and to see, well, maybe we can transition into film, give him total creative control as a writer and director. And let's see if we can bring a little bit of that Seinfeld magic to the big screen. Now, on paper, that makes a lot of sense. Big popular creator. And while not as nearly as visible as Jerry Seinfeld, people knew he was very much responsible for a lot of the sensibilities of that show and who the character, particularly of George Costanza, was there.
Well,
and if
I
you
think it also
see...
helps, though, that David was not a visible cast member, nor does he appear in this film, aside from, like, a slight extra role on screen.
Two extra roles on screen here, but yes.
But, I mean, the idea that... you know, you can sell a film as written and directed by the writer and director you didn't see on Seinfeld. And then you think, well, I liked not seeing him on screen there. Maybe I'll like not seeing him on screen here.
Well, and here's the thing. It's like, okay, that sounds like a possibility. I think there's something that's very important to keep in mind here. Larry David is a longtime writer and producer for television. He was not a director at any point prior to this. And really, when you look at everything that he's done afterwards, he has notably never directed since this.
Well, he has also rarely ever, like, even done appearances in film, to the point where, like, one of the only notable ones, if not the only other one I can think of, is, again, the Three Stooges film, where of all the roles, though, that he chose to take, he plays a nun and he wears a full habit and his character is named Sister Mary Mangala. It's a curious choice, but I mean, that being said though, David, years after this comes out, ends up sort of hitting his stride with Curb Your Enthusiasm, though that's also a show where he appears on. In some respects, it is very Seinfeldian, but it also has the advantage of being on HBO, where they can work blue, right? And they can certainly be more crass when they want to. They can curse when they want to. Things that network TV in the 90s, you couldn't do. And so Sour Grapes is an interesting hinge point, because I guess in one area you do have that creative freedom, and in some ways you kind of, I would imagine that if I was a Seinfeld fan, you kind of expect this and think, okay, so what if a Seinfeld episode was 90 minutes and rated R? That's what we're going to get here. And in a sense, that is what you get here, and, you know, they make good on that promise, but as you were nodding to, Larry David is not a filmmaker, and what you end up with, I guess, turning my cards over at this point, is a film that has moments where it is howlingly funny, but it's also not a very good film.
Well, and this is the thing. We'll get into it in just a moment here, but I would agree where this is a film that it could be, I would say, even a really good, maybe not a great movie, but it could be an extremely good movie with somebody else handling the direction of the film. Because the thing is, I'll make very clear, I like this cast. I like the premise. I like individual scenes and sequences. But there's going to be so much of this movie where you're watching it where it's like Larry David doesn't know how to necessarily stage a scene or even know when to end a scene like you would need to
Right.
in a feature film.
Because that's sort of the
But
sense I got, but I know that you have a better mind for specifics, so I'm intrigued by that. But as you said, though, we're kind of you're sold on the premise. So walk us through
yeah.
it, Dave. What is the premise of Sour Grapes?
So effectively, Sour Grapes is the story of Evan Maxwell and Richie Maxwell, played by Steven Weber. Yes, Wings and The Shining's Steven Weber and
He
Craig
was on
Bierko.
Wings. I never saw that. Steven Weber for me is a guy where I know who Steven Weber is. I cannot tell you anything that he is in.
I love Steven Weber. He's been in things like Dracula, Dead and Loving It, where he gets some of the funniest stuff to do in that movie. He's appeared in random episodes of The Outer Limits. And yes, he was the one actor who had absolutely no problem taking on the Jack Torrance role in the television miniseries version of The Shining for Mick Garris back in '97. Which is, again, his casting. I remember people being like, "Really? Steven Weber? As Jack Torrance?" It's like, yes, and I will go to bat for him. He's good. He does really good work in that film. It's not the Kubrick movie, but few things could be. But the
You're
point of the
very nice, David.
so
But yeah, it's I think though that speaks to he's more known as a comic actor, which is good. You probably wouldn't want Jack Nicholson in this film. Yeah, but like at the same time though, I think already, and even at the time, I think there's this immediate sense of maybe a downgrade or not necessarily getting the crew that that you want when you're selling a film in 1998 on Steven Weber and Craig Bierko.
Well, I mean, and this is the thing. Like, to be straight up honest here, let's go up, clear the decks on this one here, folks. When this film came out in 98, it was reviled. Like, I don't even
Yeah.
mean like bad reviews. I
Not
mean
dismissed, not, it's not that funny. Like, palpably making critics angry.
Roger Ebert was like just tore into this thing and listed it as amongst the worst movies he ever had ever seen, which is, as we'll get into, ridiculous, but that's also par for course for Roger Ebert's sort of extreme tendencies from time to time, we shall say. But I mean, yeah, when this film comes out, it barely, as near as I could tell, sees anything close to a wide release and earns next to nothing when it comes. Like, it seems like Warner Brothers ultimately did everything in its power to bury this thing there. And Larry David's been more than happy with that. Basically, even making jokes, I guess, later on in Curb about how he keeps insisting his wife not lend out copies of this to their friends because he doesn't believe it when anybody says it's good. But yeah, I mean, this
Which
is
is a very Larry David thing to do in a TV series about Larry David. You
yeah.
know, and like that just sort of speaks to his sensibility. I will say there's a lot of his writing sensibility and successful humor on display here, though. And I think, though, that's encapsulated by the fact that I guess if you can sum this movie up simply, it's one cousin lends another cousin two quarters.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, so okay, so we'll just dive right into this, folks. So follow us here. So the film opens up. We get this opening credits set to, and we should note there's no credited composer on this movie. And that's because the entire soundtrack is basically made up of classical music, there in a way that I think, and we see like literally the opening credits is basically watching a bowl of grapes on the sort of ornate dish slowly wilting as
Yeah,
the
it almost
credits.
looks like Peter Greenaway. You don't realize because it's this pristine image, and then you realize it's time lapse, and eventually Yeah, it all rots away. Symbolic.
Yeah. And it's the thing where I think what in the thing about the classical music I want to foreground here is I also think that this signals what I think Larry David's really wanting to go for, which is, again, you might sit there thinking, oh, he's trying to make sort of an absurdist classic comedy or something like that. I honestly think he's trying to invoke the Looney Tunes more than anything else there, because that dynamic of the sort of escalating absurdity of the situation that we would see in sort of like classic Chuck Jones cartoons there with Daffy and Bugs going at it really feels like that's what he's trying to do as a live action adult comedy where it's not about
And I
physical
mean, that
gags.
certainly can work. Blazing Saddles, like, once you see it as a live action, Bugs Bunny cartoon, like, you can't see it as anything otherwise, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I can make out the contours of where you see that here, but I think it's also safe to say that this is a very different kind of comedy than Blazing Saddles.
Well, that's the thing. It's not going for the grand zaniness of a cartoon there. It's more of just the central dynamics that we're seeing here in play. It's like, well, what if Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck existed in the real world? And we're just very verbose and pitted each other on these little minuscule things. But the point here is, at following this opening credit sequence, we open to probably one of the clear indicators of where I see what you're trying to do, Larry David, but you're not effectively communicating this as a director, which is we open at a funeral. And this is, set, years before when our main characters are children there, in this case. So we see the young versions of Evan, and Richie. With Richie, his father's passed away, and his mother is like comically, or at least in theory, comically sort of smothering him, in this instance, in sort of like big bear hugs where it's almost getting choked while Evan is making faces from across the aisle at him.
Well, and
And we have
she's
a
also shouting, "Make sure you take care of yourself." And the
Yeah.
priest is giving a sort of mealy mouth, like, "He was a kind man and a good man and a kind man." The
Yeah.
very banal kind of eulogy. And then we get like 20 years later, and it bridges on the note of take care of yourself to grown-up Richie, played here by Craig Bierko, who apparently was originally in the running for Chandler on Friends. And Evan, who is now a doctor performing the physical, played by grown-up Steven Weber. Which is one of those things where it's like, that's a clever segue, but when you step back and look at it, you're like, that opening scene really, like, that adds nothing to the film other than prompting that transition.
Well, but that's the th where I think this is. I see what David wants to do, but it's so clunkily executed in the direction of it. Like, ultimately, what we will find here, and massive spoilers here, he's trying to make this the bookends for the movie, where we open with the funeral and we close with the funeral. And it's this whole notion of, yes, setting up it's the sort of thing you would almost see, like, in a classic Hollywood comedy, where you see them as kids, then you jump ahead to when they're adults and they're moving on. But the visual presentation, the editing, the energy that is being sort of brought to the scene, to that initial scene, doesn't really click there. Like, it just feels weird and tonally unclear at this point. And then we suddenly jump to this, where we start to get a better sense of what David's going to be doing here, which is, yes, Seinfeld the movie without Seinfeld, but it's ultimately,
Yeah, can
yeah.
I say off the top,
Yeah.
Steven Weber as Evan is almost transparently supposed to be Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh,
And like,
absolutely.
I can't tell if that's like, I can't tell if it's a case where Weber is trying to play it like Seinfeld or not. But yeah, there's Evan is the Jerry in this dynamic.
Yes, he's a successful doctor, and not just any sort of successful doctor. Like, he is, like, he deals with high-end specialty clients, which becomes important in a moment when his secretary comes in and points out to him, it's like, there is this Mr. Pepper is here to see you in this instance. And basically, it turns out this is the star of a hit sitcom who Richie does not like. And basically, despite having no vested interest in this business.
And that sitcom is clearly supposed to be Friends.
Yes. And we'll, where I think Larry David will make his feelings on Friends very clear before it's all said and done. But yeah, I mean, Richie basically just rips into it and, to, you know, insists that this guy get pushed away. To which, you know, Steve, or to which Evans are sort of like, all right, yeah, whatever Richie says.
Feels that strongly about it. But the cousins make a plan, though, that they're gonna celebrate life, kick it up. They're going to go to Atlantic City. They're going to take their girlfriends and they're gonna gamble a bit.
Yeah, and there's a couple interesting things that are thrown here where it doesn't seem like Evan's too sure about doing this, and particularly notes that, you know, he has his daughter this weekend, which I'm fascinated by because you would think when he mentions that, you know, he's a divorced man with a daughter, that that would somehow play a much bigger role in this movie than it does.
Every time it comes up in this film, because it's so unstressed as a plot point, it is a shock because you forgot that that is an aspect of the character.
And it's one of those things where I look at, it's like, was there a subplot that was just cut from this movie?
Because maybe. Pop because it does give us like 5 seconds of Jill Talley, who I like a lot, opening a door. That also speaks to, I think, your point about the edit sort of as a general note, where there are a lot of scenes that very much end on a laugh line without really resolving, or sort of they cut at very weird points. And, you know, again, we'll pull out specific ones. But all that to say is there's some window dressing. There's Frank Sinatra's Ain't That a Kick in the Head. But Evan and his girlfriend, who is his neighbor across from the other veranda, whose name I totally remember, and I totally remember which one she is. David, help me out.
Good thing, because I think I forgot to write her name down in the credits. Oh God, this is terrible.
Right. I know, quickly going to IMDb. Happy International Women's Day. Everybody, we believe in pay equity. We are good allies, especially to our friend and not documentary 1998 film, our good friend and person that we enjoy, who is after Richard Grant in the casting. David, why is this so difficult?
My internet is refusing to cooperate. Okay, there we go. Sour grapes. There we go. What do you mean? Oh, there.
We are wonderful allies. It's not Viola Harris. Is it Karen Sillis? Oh, I hope there is. She's married to Peter Stormare.
It's booting up the page here.
Okay. Well, regardless.
yeah. So it's not
the also for the record, as a testament to how well this film is remembered, see this moment. Also, read the Wikipedia plot description because it is hilarious. And sadly, doesn't say his girlfriend's name.
It's Karen Sillis as Joan in this instance. Okay, and it's Robin Peterman, I believe, who plays Roberta, who I believe is Richie's girlfriend in this instance.
Yes.
There as well.
Wow. The point is, though, it's very much a story about the two of them. And the reason is because as they're up in Atlantic City, they're busting down on the slots. And Richie is down to his last quarter. And then Evan generously tells him to play two, because then you're eligible for the jackpot. And wouldn't you know it, three grapes come up, and Richie, yes, only Richie, has won $430,000. And, you know, it's a happy celebratory moment. They're all yucking it up. And then everybody goes back to their hotel rooms. And Evan can't help but point out that he loaned him those quarters.
Well, and this is what I love about how the sequence plays out, because from the minute you start to see Evan realize that Richie is treating us like this is his victory and his victory alone, you know something is eating at him, and Steven Weber plays just like the slow boil that's going on underneath of this whole
exactly.
time.
Because, you know, there's that long silence and then very much the, by the way, I'll have you know, and like very quickly, that in a very Larry David-esque, that becomes his character's like a mantra through the film. I loaned you 2 quarters. But, you know, all seems well, because Richie's a nice guy. He's a generous cousin, and he knows that Evan did him a favor. So he generously, in a fit of whimsy, gives him a check for $1,000. And Evan gets back, and as he notes to Joan, it's not about the money. He's a doctor. Yeah. It's about the principle. And I think that immediately establishes, first off, a very Larry David kind of character and setup, certainly for Evan. But it's the idea that, similar to the Kids in the Hall sketch where Bruce McCullough is the irate customer whose bill is late, and it keeps hinging on the idea that, okay, there was a problem. What do you actually want? Though you keep insisting that there's a principle, what do you actually want? All we know is that $1,000 doesn't satisfy that principle.
Yes, I mean, as he points, it's like, I should probably think I'm entitled to at least half, if not 2/3, based on the principle, because it took 3 quarters to play the machines, and he provided 2 of them.
The next morning at breakfast, it begins jovial until Evan draws the bomb where, nope, he's taking a firm stance. He thinks he's entitled to 2/3 of that, to which Richie seems nonplussed about it, you know, tries to make peace. It ends up escalating into a huge argument, but then Richie realizes that he doesn't need Evan's help getting back home, because he's called a limo. And then we have sort of parallel scenes of Evan returning home with Joan, and there is definitely some distance, because it very quickly becomes, oh, so you're taking his side?
Yeah.
And again, like, all of this feels very Seinfeldian, right? Yeah. You have the character that has a gripe that they don't know how to properly satisfy it, so then it flows from there to the point where they alienate everyone else, and all either man can talk about is the principle. Where in Evan's case, he loaned him the 2 cores, and in Richie's case, as he becomes braggadocious and starts basically burning all of his bridges in short order because he doesn't need money anymore. For him, it doesn't matter because he was playing the machine.
Yeah, and the thing about it here is, what I love about it is that both of their respective girlfriends take the opposite side, where Joan is like, why do you care? You don't need the money. And you've got Roberta, it's like, you never said that he lent you the 2 quarters in this instance.
Exactly. And what I do like is that every single person, pretty much every scene that introduces a new character involves one of the two cousins explaining why they're right in the situation, and everyone gives a slightly different answer.
Yeah, and it almost seems like either they're completely supporting them, or they are, it's like, well, you kind of left out that detail. And in this instance, like, I mean, in one of the ones that doesn't quite work, and again, it's a scene that could, which is ultimately Roberta decides she doesn't want to be in the limo. She's just going to take the bus to get back to the city. So Richie's in the limo alone, talking with the limo driver in this instance. And the driver's completely with him in this instance until Richie suddenly points out that, you know,
because he's agreeing, because he's like, well, you know, he loaned you the quarters, so all you owe him is the loaned amount, give him 50 cents. And then Richie does that. Well, he didn't specifically use the word loan. It's like, oh, well, that's very different.
Exactly.
And again, that's a very Larry David sort of dialogue pivot in a scene.
It is. The problem then becomes the escalation and how it's staged, because suddenly Richie flips on a dime, basically insults the guy, and then rather than, I mean, you can see how in theory this was supposed to play out, where They get more and more heated, and it builds and builds and builds until the limo driver finally freaks out, jumps in the back, and throws Richie to the road. The problem is it jumps...
Sidney does that immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, again, it's one of those things where it's like, and this is where Larry David, you're not quite a director, because a director would have known, it's like, you gotta let this bit play out a little longer before this happens. But ultimately, Richie, yeah, and Evan both make their way back. They're in loggerheads. Richie, we should note here, is apparently renting the home for his mother, who's fully supportive of him not spending a dime on Evan. It's like, no, you don't owe him anything. Don't give him nothing. Much to Roberta's.
And Selma, played by Viola Harris, yes, she's the doting, very much archetypal, doting Jewish mother to Richie. But, you know, it's, it is, like, these scenes are funny.
Yes.
The problem is that there are a lot of scenes along the way that more or less exist as Evan slash Richie encounters new character, has a funny dialogue exchange about the problem, and then the scene ends.
Yeah.
So it feels like there's a lot of amusing beats, but like in terms of overall plot structure, it kind of just doesn't do anything except have both guys complaining for a while until, and again in a Larry David way, you know, the MRI results that Richie was waiting on from his physical come back. And things start escalating in a very dark way as this gives Evan an idea.
Yeah, because the thing is, they were checking on basically this thing on the back of Richie's head here. And this is following a scene where, you know, Richie attempts to bury the quote-unquote hatchet with Evan in this instance, with Evan giving Richie a birthday gift, which turns out to be this kind of blue tracksuit that Richie accepts, quote-unquote, graciously, even though he really doesn't want it, and then basically proceeds to give a much, you know, offer 3% of the winnings.
Yeah, the absurdly specific number of 3%.
Exactly, which Evan does not take terribly kind to in this instance. And ultimately, when Richie leaves, he gives the tracksuit to a homeless man in this instance, played by, of all people in this instance, Orlando Jones. And this is Digby. He will become important, trust me. And it honestly
surprisingly important.
Yeah, and it took me a while to realize it was Orlando Jones, because his whole head is shaved here, so he has no hair, and it took me a while to realize, oh, that's him, that is Orlando Jones. He does not look like I was anticipating in this movie. But yeah, the big thing here is that ultimately Evan decides, as fair play to Richie, he's going to call him there and ask him to come back to the office right away, which he does, and he explains to him that he basically has about 3 months left, maybe only two, in this instance.
And there's that scene of, you know, it's the comedy of cruelty, because you watch the scene of Evan telling him, and you can see that Evan is trying so hard to be solemn while being delighted at the same time, and very pleased with himself, right?
And then you've got Richie, who's going home distraught, basically just walks home in the rain, comes in completely soaked and wet. His mother spots him and insists that he come home with her for some soup in this instance. Yeah. And
now, here's the thing, though, because as you were saying, like with the limo driver, there is a very sharp escalation that kind of is so untethered as an emotional response, because in this case, Richie then forms a plan where he ends up tracking down Digby once again, gives him a key to his mother's house because he reasons that he's going to die and his mom is so protective of him that it would be better to have a homeless person break into her house, give her a heart attack, and then she dies mercifully before he does.
And the thing is, David tries to set it up earlier in the scene going to Atlantic City, where the four of the friends talk about, you know, what would happen to her if something were to happen to Richie.
And the opening funeral also speaks to that. And I mean, it's a plot point that's established, but like, I feel like as a plot point, though, it's also pretty nonsensical. In a way that feels different from like the absurdity of other aspects of the film. And I only say that because this ends up being like the majority plot point and consequences from this for the second half of the film.
Well, yeah, because what ends up happening is, yes, Richie decides to go with this plan. And again, in sort of speaking, I think, to the problem with David here, where it's not just that, the escalation happens, because I think there's a way the escalation could potentially work. But again, watching the way it plays out, he goes for like the obvious choices where we stay outside the home as Digby goes in. There, we just hear a shriek, a fall down, and then he runs out in this instance. And of course, Richie gets home just in time to get the message from Evan, just indicating it. Yeah, it's a whole complete lie. It's like, I'm just getting back at you for what went on here. And then we cut to the following day where what ended up happening was Pepper, the actor of this Friends-like sitcom in this instance here, shows up because his thing is it turns out that he actually has an injury to his testicle, and basically it's causing inflammation, which, as Evan points out, it's like, well, basically the only thing we can do is remove that single testicle, but your other one will be fine in this instance, to which Pepper is like, fine, but I really want you to carry out the surgery in this instance. I trust you. You're the best. So
And here's the
ultimately,
thing, though, Dave. I'm not
yeah.
sure how it is in New York jurisdiction, but I'm pretty sure that if you are a surgeon specialist that operates on testicles, you also don't do neurosurgery, too.
Yeah, I am reasonably sure that is also the case.
Okay, just making sure I'm not crazy. But
No, yeah,
again,
I.
and it doesn't have to be real, but that speaks to sort of like the sort of the general comedy tier where all that really matters is he's a doctor, and that's what enables him to be in situations that the plot requires.
Well, exactly. So ultimately, what ends up happening is, as they're prepping for the surgery, there's an emergency call from Richie to Evan before the surgery, which he decides to take. And in one of the effective shots where Larry David does show some visual sense, we get this slow push into Steven Weber's face as you just hear him taking in the news of what Richie's filling in about what happened
Yeah, but you don't hear Richie on the phone, right?
No,
Because it's just
exactly.
the surgery room, and it's one of the rare moments of quiet in this movie.
Yeah.
Because again, it's not quite like the rapidity of like Marx Brothers or Howard Hawks or anything like that, but there it is very much a rapid back and forth dialogue based film. So
Yeah.
this moment, the slow track, and then eventually, it's also effective because he's wearing the full surgical mask, but you just sort of see the eyes widen a little bit and then
Yeah.
freeze, and then nothing really happens, but then he just lets the phone drop from his shoulder, and you're like, oh, it was that kind of conversation.
And then he wanders over to the wall and puts up the X-ray slide there to perform the surgery based off of, which is going to be very important in a moment because, yes, while Richie's busy dealing with the cops who are questioning, it's like, so, okay, what happened in this instance here? And I do love the scene where the officer in this instance played.
Interviewing the neighbors. It's Richard Grant, who I popped for because he's the cop in The Big Lebowski, whose only line of dialogue is, or the credence. He's the head detective here, and he's interviewing the elderly Jewish neighbors. And again, there's something very classical about it, and there's something very tropey, like the police interviewing well-meaning, doddering old folks. But it's also really funny, this whole scene. Especially like beginning with the well, you heard a scream? What kind of a scream was it? What do you mean, what kind of scream was it? It was a scream. There's only one kind of scream. Well, there are different kinds, but we won't get into that.
Then finally, when he's like, "Can you describe what the suspect looked like?" And they're trying everything they think to be politely not say that he was a black individual in this
Exactly. Like, they're
instance.
so afraid that if they describe the suspect as black, that makes them racist. So Richard Grant just assures them, was he black? They're like, oh, yes, but honestly, that doesn't mean anything. Next person who comes running by could be a white person, could be Chinese.
Jesus, yes.
And it sort of it peaks with describing the hairstyle, and she doesn't want to say Afro because she wasn't sure if that was okay. And there's something like this is almost a sort of a sweet scene, which is unexpected because it's also very different than the current type of joke around, oh, I wasn't sure if I was able to say that term. This is from the other angle where it's like, I really don't want to offend you, sir.
Well, yeah, and you've got
Yeah, but they
Richard.
ID they put an ID on Digby, who they late very soon track down. And he basically says that a man who matches Richie's description gave him a key to the house and told him to go in there.
Yeah, exactly. And this ends up, he asked, did she die? It's like, well, no, but she's in the hospital, in this. And sure enough, they go to visit Richie and start trying to piece
Well, I also
together.
love Digby's thing where he's like, oh, okay, well, I wish well for her, because I have no malice,
Exactly.
aforethought.
And while, yeah, this is all going on and Richie's getting very panicked trying to deal with the police, we cut back to Evan, who's successfully completed the surgery, except one of the two things happen. One, we have one nurse who suddenly starts giving him a massage at this point, which he starts pointing out. It's like, what are you doing? It's like, you said to give you a massage afterwards. I asked you to untie me afterwards. These don't even
I thought you
sound
said
alike.
massage.
Exactly.
Untie massage.
Yeah.
They don't sound alike. Thought you said
Exactly.
massage. It's just, and like, I love whenever any movie makes just a weird joke like this. This is Zeppo Marx walking into a scene from the side wearing a hat, turning, pausing, looking towards the camera and showing that he is wearing half a hat, looking at it with confusion and throwing it away. I love comedy that hits that tier of why, like, how do you write a joke like this and have it work? There's something amazing about it. And, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that throughout this film, there are absolutely hilarious exchanges and lines and little things like this where I thought you said massage me. It's just like it takes up 15 seconds of screen time. It is not operative and it is hysterical.
And more so than the bit that follows after, when it the other nurse points out, it's like, doctor, come over here and take a look at this. It's like, is this, X-ray in in reverse? And quickly, Evan realizes that it is because he was so distraught over the phone call, he put it up the wrong way and performed the wrong surgery on the wrong
Yes.
testicle. So
So
he has
Danny
to.
is now castrated.
Yes, and again, we see Danny wake up. Evan just sort of explains, like, there was a little bit of a mistake that happened here
Yeah.
while
And I
this is
like that
going.
it's the head-on framing, sort of the POV shot. As we see
Yeah.
Evan like smiling in the, how you feeling, man? Okay, so there was a problem. And again, even though I've clearly established I'm not a diehard Steven Weber fan, or even know many things he has been in, I like how he plays this scene. And like, I don't know if it's quite like long a take, or I don't recall offhand what the editing pattern overall is, but it feels like an extended monologue, and I think he does it pretty well.
Yeah, there's a couple of shot reverse shots in there, but we never hear Pepper played, who's played by Matt Kiesler, here, we should note. He never gets a line of dialogue in this moment here because he's all hooked up to the machines, very drowsy at this point. And again, I do love the use of there seems to be a slight fish angle lens that's being used to sort of
Yeah.
exaggerate Weber's face a bit.
And more to the point, like this is the kind of shot setup that you can't really do on network TV. And so here's one of those moments where you can see, Larry David, in a lot of ways, doesn't seem comfortable working filmically, but like this is a film-specific way of staging this scene that actually works really well.
Yeah, this is, yeah, one of the
Even
few.
though like the joke itself of medical malpractice, or associating the fact that, well, there's almost something like Freudian giggle about it, where it's like it's a big joke because we accidentally removed a man's testicles. That's kind of banal, but I mean, the staging of this scene is really effective.
Well, absolutely. But basically the end result of all this whole section is two things. One, Roberta catches wind of and finally figures gets Richie to admit, well, what is on earth is going on? Why were the police around? What's happening? And when he finally admits it, she basically decides, enough's enough. This is ridiculous. I'm gone. And takes off. And likewise, as sorry,
Joan.
Joan is going back with Evan to his apartment, and she's treating him. It's like, I cannot believe how am I this? How can I go back and face his gr lady friend? She very deliberately puts it's like lady friend, and talk with her. I have to work with her in this instance, and I recommended you. And of course, Evan and all this thing. It's like, here's the thing about this, Joan. What really surprises me out of all of this. It's not this, it's not these reactions. It's the fact that you still refuse to accept, you still think that I am the wrong one in this whole Richie
Exactly. They were
situation.
my quarters. And again, as far afield as we get, it does remember more often than not to link whatever's happening to the originating conflict of Evan lent him two quarters. There's a
Exactly.
principle here. And I love there is another beat in this scene which just killed me, where Evan is self-righteously like defending himself and doing the I don't need you anyway, and then all of a sudden at the tail end of a sentence it's like and I never want to see you again. And he
Yeah.
basically just does a Scarface accent for the very tail end of an angry monologue, which Joan and then, like, the absolute stone face sincerity. It's like, did you just speak with a Spanish accent right then? No. Okay. Because you sounded very Spanish for a moment. And it's, what on earth is happening? I love when this film does it. I just wish it did it more.
I
Instead,
also
it sort of, I think it overly emphasizes, things that in 1998 you can certainly see why they were on vogue. Like the whole movie Tomcats is based around testicular trauma. And and the recurring gag of Richie being able to autofillate, but
Yeah.
like it emphasizes these moments a lot more than it does just these weird little jokes that they just add in. There's that one Van Damme movie where the woman opens the drawer and there's a birthday cake inside it at a police station. It's like
Hard
movies need
target.
to do that more.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And I mean, and I even love the way in which the scene ends, where she's going to do the big dramatic walkout, grabs the door, realizes it's locked, tries to jiggle the lock and jiggle the door. It's not working. So ultimately, Evan has to go over there and help unjiggle, undo the locks. Goes to open the door himself. It still won't open. So he has to fight with the door again just to let her out. It's one of those moments where this is a scene going on a little bit longer than you would think, but actually works in this instance here. But yeah, I mean, with all this
Oh,
going
and at the
on.
same time, Digby, who still has the house key,
Yeah.
everybody moves into mom's house. By
Yeah.
everybody, it's basically like your most cookie cutter, generic bums that you could
Yeah.
think of in 1990s culture.
Exactly. So we then cut to basically what ends up happening is with his mom in the hospital, it turns out that yes, they do need to perform a very, very particular surgery in
Yeah,
order
because
to
she
help her.
recovered from the heart attack, but she ruptured something in her brain. They need a cranial specialist to do it, and Richie does not want to work with the one that they have proposed because, again, a very Larry David moment. I asked him to hold the elevator, and he acted like he was pressing the button, but he didn't.
Exactly. And this will eventually tie in with the fact that he asks one of the nurses to give these cookies to his mother, which will become a point when he starts realizing, I didn't, you know, she didn't have the cookies. Where was the cookies? Where did they end up here? Did you steal the cookies in this instance here? It just, again, like Richie, he is very much the George Costanza character of this film, where he finds ways to dig his own grave and get people angry at him over the course of it here. And yeah, ultimately the big thing is that, yeah, he has to get Richie to agree to this, which leads to a confrontation where the basically, yes, they basically laid out, it's like, look, this is your fault in many ways. I think you kind of owe it. Well, look, I'm not doing it because I've committed just wasn't able to commit a surgery because of this whole situation here. So I'm not doing any practice for a little while going on.
Oh, yeah. Which, it does give us that great scene with the receptionist where he's like, cancel all of my appointments. Okay, how do you want me to tell them? What do you mean? As a group or individually? Does it matter? I guess not. I'll tell them individually. And then he pauses and points out, but if you tell them individually, eventually they're going to realize what's happening. I'll tell them as a group.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, yeah, just, oh God, it's those small exchanges that work so well in this film. But meanwhile, while this is going on, we then cut back with Pepper himself in this instance. Because the thing is, well, first we see Evan go to actually see that daughter and ex-wife of his that we have that were briefly mentioned and then completely forgotten from the rest of this movie.
What follows from this movie as well. Like, exactly. I don't remember this scene even going anywhere other than Jill Talley opening the door and Steven Weber having maybe like 10 seconds of dialogue with his daughter.
Well, the key thing here is ultimately the point of the daughter and the ex-wife is kind of irrelevant. He's here to pick up his daughter for, you know, his visitation, but she wants to finish watching her favorite show before they leave.
Oh, right.
Which turns out, of course, to be our Not Friends Friends show here.
Which is a spot-on parody of the opening, though. Oh, I've got to say, like, it is tremendously apt. And again, like, there are some, it's sort of like the difference between Naked Gun and like epic movie, right? Where there's a kind of parody where, like, as they say, comedy is a man in a silly hat who doesn't realize it's a silly hat the moment you start pointing to the audience saying, look how silly this hat is. This is just a great gag because Larry David and co, they understand everything that is unique and memorable about the Friends opening credit sequence, even down to the music. And it's just uproarious because it is so perfectly done.
Exactly. But we see the scene start to play out with the typical Friends sort of set up for shenanigans when Pepper walks out in his character, prepares to speak. And of course, it's in a falsetto at this point, to which Evan can just sort of lift his head, look up at this and realize as his daughter is speaking, Dad, why does his voice sound like that? Which then cuts to, yes, a bunch of network and studio executives, one of which is played by Larry David here, basically saying, hey, we think you should take a bit of a break here, you know, just until this whole voice thing works itself out.
We'll send your character to Alaska. And he, in falsetto, angrily points out, he's a courtroom sketch artist. And then they just have, like, this whole stray conversation about they don't have courts in Alaska. The Eskimos, it's the decision of the tribal chief. And then that casual, like, throwaway, well, there's a bad element anywhere you go. You got people stealing canoes.
Oh, God, yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like you're walking a very fine line here, Larry David. But,
well, but I mean, it works because it's that sort of absolute obliviousness of other people that is being, that is the subject of comedy here. Cracked me up anyway. But so Danny is off the show and we get a couple scenes of him flying to New York. And as we realize, stalking Evan in the shadows of the city. This kind of culminates, I guess, with Evan successfully performing brain surgery on a family member, which again, I don't think they really let you do, but it ends up being successful, and Evan is you know goes out to tell Richie. Richie is very grateful, and Evan announces the bill is going to be exactly half of the money, but
And
then
in
Richie
cash.
just smiles
Yeah.
and yes, he agrees. And then Evan goes home, and we get what feels like a contrivance that would be more allowable in a sitcom, the way this pays off. But as
Yeah.
he sits down, we get a scene that, again, a lot of the comedy hinges on the fact that Danny is trying to be menacing. He's pointing a gun and threatening to kill Evan, but he's speaking in a falsetto.
Yeah.
But he lures him out to the balcony. They have a scuffle. Joan runs in from the other balcony, runs in, grabs a briefcase that's just sitting there, and decides this will be the weapon, and somehow hits Danny on the back, but in a way where the briefcase goes flying and lands on the sidewalk, which Digby then catches and finds.
And of course, it's
And
all the
then it
money.
ends.
Yeah.
Yes, and it ends with Danny then being consoled by Joan while Evan sits there alone and without his money.
Well, and what gets me about the scene is it feels like it's paying off a joke that just doesn't work for me. Where Danny's, where she's sort of almost like trying to seduce her and be interested in Danny. It's like, but I have no balls, and she's like, I know. There, and it feels like this is supposed to be like the payoff to some gag throughout that was running through it, but that
Well, it
gag doesn't
is. It's just
exist.
not a very funny gag.
Yeah.
It's great payoff because she loves him anyway, even if he doesn't have his nuts, like
Yeah.
that kind of vein of
Yeah.
comedy, I guess, which isn't what this film is doing all the time. And when it works best, it's not doing that at all.
Yeah.
But
But they're.
meanwhile, Richie, though, is thrilled because with his mom back to health, she is no longer going to die anytime soon, and he doesn't have to worry about jail. But unbeknownst to him, while his mother was in the hospital, Digby and Co. wrecked the house, more or less. And so we get its own kind of bookend scene, though, of Richie bringing her home, even the dead flowers, and then walking her to the door, saying you'll see her for dinner, and then we stay outside the house as she walks in, closes the door, and then we hear a thud. Cut to another funeral.
Which, yeah, we see people sort of coming up and consoling Richie and offering their condolences. And then, of course.
And then, if I can be honest, though, I thought the eulogy was pretty dreadful.
Exactly. Which is bad enough. But then the landlord, who we didn't talk about earlier, who had come in to see the damage that had been done there, says, "Is this a bad time? I just want to talk to you about the bill here."
He says, "Of course it's a bad time. It's my mother's funeral."
Exactly. And of course it's like, well, this was the damage that was done. It's like, this is ridiculous. This is more money than the house was worth in this here. And of course it's all the remaining money that Richie has from the weddings there. Meanwhile, yeah, as he's heading out, Evan's arriving
And Evan
late.
shows up 15 minutes
It's
late for the
late.
funeral,
Yeah.
but the two of them more or less some kind of comfort one another, and it all culminates with Evan saying he has to feed the meter. Can he borrow 2 quarters?
Yeah. Just to look at one
And
another.
that,
Yeah.
yeah, and then Richie goes back to his house, realizing that his back is flexible again, so he can then auto-fillet. And then we end on Evan going back to his office, greeting a recurring patient throughout the film. And what was their dialogue exchange there? I don't even think I caught it because the film just ends after this.
Yeah, I
And it
forget
doesn't
what
seem
the.
like a significant enough line to end the film on.
No, it just sort of ends with everybody back in place, or at least Evan and Richie, having learned effectively nothing from this entire experience, right back to where they were. Again, they're not
Well,
punished. They're not
I guess
really.
if we learn anything, it's like Fargo, right? Where it's
Yeah.
like, what does it actually get you? Nobody ends up with what they wanted, and everybody's kind of back to where they start. And I mean, I don't think it would be a Larry David film if it ends with, characters explaining what they've learned through the film. I think there's, very something very purposeful, the fact that nothing is really learned, but there is a sense of at least moving on by the end of it, which is a kind of emotional closure you often didn't get with Seinfeld. But yeah, I guess the question is, I think in order to understand why this film had such a critical backlash that we were noting, you have to root yourself in the mindset of being a critic who enjoyed Seinfeld at the time that this movie came out. Because there are a lot of things, again, that feel very tonally like auteurist about Larry David's writing style and the way that he introduces certain concepts and certain kinds of like extended dialogue exchanges. It does feel very relatable there, but this is not Seinfeld the movie. This does feel very different, and I wonder how much of that in itself explains the anger, because it's not just, well, this is a movie that certainly has funny moments. It's hard to say that it's a great comedy movie, though, or even necessarily a good or effective one. Because again, there's something very vignette-y about it. And the problem is that works when you're writing for Saturday Night Live. It works when you're doing it for 25 minutes, but to do that. And I mean, we certainly see like the Saturday Night Live movie is its own category of bad, generally, right? The idea that some things don't cross over, and you don't have to be a medium essentialist or anything like that to simply note that there are ways of creating a narrative work over 90 minutes in a theatrical setting than there is making network TV, and for good or for ill, it's different than that. But there also is something that keeps me from seeing this as a movie I'm like that I would proactively recommend to people, other than it's not nearly as bad as people make it out to be.
Well, I think the thing about it here, I think there's two things. Why the backlash? I think there's probably two factors. I want to say it because of the sort of heights Larry David had hit with Seinfeld at the time. There was going to be that inevitable backlash of people coming after him in this thing. It seemed like you literally cannot seem to succeed to those kinds of levels without people looking to take you down a peg, either consciously or unconsciously on that. I think that's part of it. I would also say the other part of it is that if Seinfeld was a show that was willing to go pretty darn dark for network television and be as unsentimental as it was, this pushes it a little bit further. And I think, I mean, for people who are used to, like, I have not seen the whole of Curb Your Enthusiasm, but Curb Your Enthusiasm goes way darker than Seinfeld even did during its heyday there. And I think this is a Sour Grapes is really a preview of where things were going to go for David going there. And I think
But Curb Your Enthusiasm, though, is a show that has proven to be, certainly not Seinfeld-esque in its popularity, but a show that does have a dedicated following, is critically successful, has a built-in and expanding audience in ways that this film simply does not have.
Well, no, absolutely. I think a large part of it, again, I always come back to the fact that I don't think Larry David is a director. And I think a large part of it is having to work with other people and having other people work with the actors and work with the staging and having other people come in to sort of edit as an additional filter on David probably helps so much in keeping things tight and focused and making sure things are progressing and that the tone is always level here. Because there are moments where, yeah, the tone will go from, stuff that perfectly works to things that are just a little too zany. We will have those sequences that just sort of drift on a little too long or don't go on long enough there. And I think a lot of that just comes down to David just did not at this time have the chops. And I think it's very telling that he never went on to direct anything again, because I don't get the sense that he particularly enjoyed the notion of being the one and only person who's completely at the center of everything like that.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think it's also speaking to maybe that unfamiliarity. Like, there are a number of scenes in this film, for as many good ones there are, where, like, it's not that the scene is bad, but that the scene exists for a gag that is completely disconnected for the plot. So it seems like this was something that was jotted down on an ideas pad like 15 years ago, and then they were just like, well, we need a couple more scenes for this movie. And so you end up getting like the one where Evan and Joan are in bed and they're not talking about plot points. They're not even arguing about the quarters. But they try to be passionate, and then it turns out they're both trying to climb on top at the same time. And then they just sort of struggle horizontally, locked in battle. And then the scene ends. And it's like, this literally could have been taken out of the film. Like, it is disconnected from the rest of the film. And like, this scene. That's why I mean when it exists to tell its joke, but the joke itself is, like general comedy principle where you can plug that into any other property you're working on. Does that make sense?
I think it does make sense. And it's the thing, yeah, when the jokes work and the jokes click, it's fine. And trust me, when we get to hits and pits, there's one scene in particular I have to highlight that
Yes.
is nothing to do with anything else in this movie, but is might be the best scene of it altogether.
I know exactly what you mean.
But then you have other things, yeah, when the joke simply does not play or it's flat or it just happens and it's just sitting there flailing around desperately trying to find a hook. Or things like, yeah, the whole subplot with Danny Pepper, which the way in which that ends, it's I see what, again, they're going for, but it doesn't work. Nobody knows how to communicate it or work it. And part of it's also the fact that it's introduced so late into the game that it doesn't really have a chance to build in any meaningful way with it either. So I honestly think like it's a film that I am not going to make the case and say that this is a brilliant, misunderstood masterpiece here.
Yeah. Like, great bits don't necessarily add up to a great film.
Yeah, they don't add up to a great film, but I'm also going to sit there and say if you're a Larry David fan and you haven't seen this based on its reputation, you owe it to yourself to check it out because there is a lot about his work that's there and that does work. And I would also even say, even if you're just curious, it's not a miserable 90 minutes of time there. Like, I can't say, like, I mean, when stuff doesn't work, I wasn't being necessarily actively angry at it. Like, you need to ride out like the first 16, 20 minutes. Like, don't get me wrong. That stuff is probably the roughest it is. But once
Yeah.
the central premise
Like,
kicks into gear, it's in much surer
it
footing.
feels weirdly padded in some ways, but like again, it's the kind of film where I would say that it's odd because most of it is very middling, but there are maybe a half dozen jokes in this film and scenes to see play out that are just so brilliantly funny. That it's like you need to see these scenes from the film, and I would recommend them to everyone without necessarily saying that about the film itself. But I mean, as you were noting though, it does sort of form an interesting hinge point because, Larry David not really working in film for the most part following this, and certainly not directing in it. But I think this is our first foray, as you said, in sort of seeing what Curb Your Enthusiasm becomes, because while it's not quite Seinfeld rated R, it ends up being very different kind of beast than that. It's not as far away from that, I guess that premise manifesting itself as you might think either. So I don't know. It's a curious thing. Some highs, some lows, and maybe all the more reason we make like Larry David and ourselves will ourselves to forget 1998 Sour Grapes. But before we can do that, we need to turn to our patent pending bumper segment where we celebrate those same highs and lows, hits and pits. David, for a film that, we're transparent, there are some wonderful things about. What is your first wonderful hit for Sour Grapes?
The scene when Richie basically quits in front of his boss, Mr. Bell.
Yeah.
Because.
Because Richie is specifically a sole designer for a shoe company.
Exactly. And at one point, he's just, you know, BSing with his friends who are insisting. It's like, well, why can't you buy lunch for all of us? I mean, you've got the money. It's like, I'm not going to be paying for lunch for everyone. But finally enough, this leads to, it's like, oh, Mr. Bell wants to see you. And sure enough, where she goes in, and Mr. Bell is played by Philip Baker Hall.
Yes, and, of all people, Philip Baker Hall.
Yeah, and God bless him, he is note perfect in the scene, where basically Richie comes in, and he's like, you wanted to see me, Mr. Bell? Yeah. The shoe. I don't like it. What do you mean you don't like it? I don't like the sole. It's got these circles. Yeah, the circles.
Circles within circles. Too many circles. I don't like it. No. See, sir? That's where you're wrong. No, I don't think so. And then just immediately Richie flips the switch and does the whole, you know what? I don't need this job. But again, Philip Baker Hall being Philip Baker Hall plays off it so incredibly well.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's just all deadpan, no reactions. Like, well, fine. Go. Like it's just like they just, it's like, yeah, you'll realize you're wrong. No, I won't, but you will.
Exactly.
No.
Just, I design great shoes. No? No, you don't. Well, that's your opinion. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, take care of yourself. I intend to. I would assume so. Then why bring it up?
It's just, it's so utterly absurd, and Craig Bierko, as he's trying to, like, you know, he desperately wants to get the last word in, but he has no concept of how to do it.
Exactly. And Philip Baker Hall, again, just very solidly firing this man because he doesn't like the circles, and whether or not he is a capable shoe designer.
Exactly.
And even, I mean, it pays off later because Richie's arguing with his girlfriend and pointing out he was right in here. And she's like, I don't like the new shoes. They have a lean to them. No, they don't have a lean to them. They're amazingly designed shoes. It's true. Richie's an excellent sole designer. What do you mean he didn't like the circles?
It is. Oh, my God. It's like, this is the most of all the moments in this film that are clear Seinfeld things. This absolutely would have been a scene with George and one of his many bosses over the course of the show. They're like, unmistakably. Yeah. And it is just, it is a note-perfect scene. And if nothing else, I have no idea if it's been released in isolation on YouTube. If it hasn't, somebody, I'm not recommending you do this illegally, but if you're the person prone to doing this and want to let people know where they can see it, I wouldn't stop you, because it is a scene worth watching. It is just a delight.
I mean, that would be my first hit as well, simply because that's just how funny this little capsule scene is. You know, and there's no more Philip Baker Hall after this. It's just, it's one and done, but what a one it is. I would say, though, giving my other hit, I guess, because it feels tacky to just list off hilarious punchlines, I would probably give it to Craig Bierko, only because, like, I know the name Craig Bierko. I know him from two other movies, which are, again, the Farrelly Brothers Three Stooges movie, which, you know, is probably less enjoyable than this one. I would put Sour Grapes higher, if that means anything to you at home. But 2000? The 13th Floor, which is another one of those movies that very much of its time. But that was Craig Bierko as, like, a dark and brooding leading man in a dramatic performance. Here, he kind of... He's playing a character that has sort of the Costanza sensibilities, but he's tall, he's broad, he sort of does, like, the Kramer physicality at the same time. I guess more often than not, he is pretty charming in the scenes where he's written to be. And, like, I don't know, there is something where, not to say that anything about Bierko's performance means, you know, he's a great dramatic actor or shows indicators of that, but he definitely does show some capability and range as a comic actor to the point where you wonder why he wasn't getting those opportunities. Because he at least shows enough here that it's like, well, you know, this could have been a vein that, you know, maybe not flourished in, but more roles like this I can see him doing well. You know,
Well,
the problem is, it's just if you look at the filmography, there's not a lot of any kind of roles for Craig Bierko.
it's the thing, right? He fell into the character actor more than anything else after this. And I think the thing about it is that honestly, you're right. I think he could have had a breakout thing. He's got the right charisma and energy that he brings to this role here. And I think the basic problem is that they stopped making those kinds of comedies that he would have been a surefire fit for as we went into the 2000s. This is the rise of the bro humor that I cannot stand, where that it sort of came up. And Craig Bierko does not communicate that at all.
And I mean, like, he's in Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
He's in The Long Kiss Goodnight, but nobody comes out of those movies remembering, oh man, what a great Craig Bierko performance.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I think he found a very comfortable groove doing, character work in film and television. And television in particular, he's had quite a bit of success that way. Like, he's not never been the leading man, but he's definitely made a good, steady working career out of it there. So I mean, I would imagine he's probably very satisfied with where he's ended up. I mean, sure, I have no doubt that, he wanted that big breakthrough success, but you can't say that he didn't take a shot at it here, or in the 13th Floor. Like in both instances, like he, commits to those performances. They're unquestionably. So yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I would also say that brings me to my second hit because I can't not give it to Steven Weber. Steven Weber is just like I
Like,
like
once you
him.
calibrate to the fact that whether by design or not, he's effectively playing Jerry Seinfeld for large stretches of this film, like once you wrap your head around that, he is also pretty funny in this.
Well, and this is the thing. Like, I mean, Weber's got his own weird energy and delightfulness. And I always love the fact, like, he's just always been this low-key, quirky actor who will just pop up in weird random places and like things like this, or again, showing up in like he's appeared in like three or four different Stephen King adaptations over the years. My God, like he just pops up in places you don't
He's
expect.
the
It's
on-screen Frank Darabont.
well, in some way, like he's just like he never seems to get his just due. Like Wings was a success, do not get me wrong. But most people came out of Wings thinking, that Tony Shalhoub was awesome. And that's because Tony Shalhoub is awesome.
Tony
Tim
Shalhoub was
Daly.
on Wings? I have never
Yeah.
seen Wings.
He was on Wings. Tim Daly was on Wings. Steven Weber was on Wings. Wings was a good show, folks. I will stand by that. But I mean, but that's the thing. Like, Wings is one of those shows that's kind of quietly, it's not quite forgotten, but it's become one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, that was a thing. And then, there's Steven Weber who keeps going on doing good work in just oddball places. Like he's never gonna probably break out and be, I mean, I would imagine probably not, but when you look at the body of work of stuff he's done, he's low key kind of awesome in his way, and I'm always charmed whenever he pops up in something. So I mean, and again, he plays well off of Craig Bierko. They're effectively being the straight man, but even in being a straight man, just having like just such
A
wonderful
petty
quiet.
jerk of a straight man.
Exactly, and he's just so delightful those things. And his like whatever Jennifer Lee Warren, who plays the secretary, like they have a great fire back and forth chemistry throughout this movie, but I kind of wish was explored more because again, they're just able to rapid fire off of one another and just play off of one another and do it delightfully here. And again, it's kind of the shame where it's like,
Well,
man, I
yeah, like when he
wish.
comes in and complains about, and he gave the jogging suit to a bum. The jogging suit I got him. You mean that I got him? Yeah, well, I paid for it though. Like
exactly.
he's that character in this movie, but like he does that character pretty well.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, I liked this film well enough, and it made me laugh out loud at a bunch of times. But again, there's something ephemeral, and I've been sort of looking forward to this part because it's sort of, again, it's hard to put your finger on where this film sort of goes wrong, or figuring out one reason to clearly assign some blame. I can think of one, though, for the pits of this film. Before I do, though,
Okay.
Dave, considering this film comes out in 1998, I've never seen a trailer, but I can almost guarantee it was something like, "This is the story of Richie and Evan. One got rich, Now one's getting even.
Yeah, I did not act. I should have looked up the trailer for this thing beforehand, but I would not be surprised if that was the case. Like, I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. It's we should look at trailers more, especially for notorious flops, because maybe it's a case of just thinking you're getting a different movie than what it becomes. But the one thing that I can clearly point to as a pit for this film probably would lie in the editing,
Yeah.
and that would go to Priscilla Ned Friendly, who worked on the less good Big Mama's House, the second one. First one is legit a hilarious movie, and I will fight people on that. I guess David may be unfamiliar as a director, but I think having people in place and like the key people doing their key roles can sometimes help you through that. As we said, like there's some very interesting scenes where it's firing on all cylinders on a formal level. For the most part, though, like there's something that just feels rhythmically off with a lot of the editing, specifically with the ending of scenes. And like I guess encapsulating that, there's the one where the cousins bump into each other outside the hospital and they start arguing, and it peaks with them getting closer and closer until they're both announcing that, well, stop pointing at me, I'm gonna point at you, and then they're both pointing at each other, and then it just ends. Like it's just a cut to another scene. There's no dissolve, there's no transition, which is odd because this film opens with the funeral scene, which, as I noted, like largely is there simply to give us that transition. Whereas like the rest of the film has no thought paid to getting from one scene to another, other than a flat cut after a punchline. And it feels pretty flat, aside from the moments where those punchlines are hitting, I guess. I don't know. There definitely seems to be something with the editing of this film that I don't think you can solely attribute to directorial vision.
I go back and forth on this because I want to give Priscilla Ned Friendly a bit of credit. She also would go on to edit things like The Proposal, Pretty Woman, and Eddie and the Cruiser. So it's not a case that she's, someone who I think is without talent. I think this might be a case where she was struggling with the footage she had from David to find some of those ins and outs on this. But I'd say either way, the editing doesn't quite click into place in this particular instance. So whether her or just even a case of she made the best of what she's got, the editing's still a problem in this movie,
Oh yeah,
regardless.
it's I mean, like we've seen other films like The In-Laws more recently, where like good editing is not only enhances, but it's kind of crucial to like a great comedy film, because so much of comedy and verbal comedy is the rhythm of dialogue and sort of the rapidity of the interplay. And when the editing is off, it sort of ruptures that rhythm. And not to say that more fluid editing would make this in the upper echelon of comedy films. I think its problems run further than that, but it certainly doesn't have that helping it along.
Well, no, absolutely. On that note there, I gotta admit, probably most of the Danny Pepper subplot just doesn't work in this movie. Like, I it's probably the broadest and cheapest joke that's going on throughout it, and I get what David's trying to do, and I would almost agree, honestly, as somebody who was not a super big fan of Friends when it was on television, I kind of feel his sort of negative feelings towards it that's presented here. But it is like, as an actual ongoing plot line, it just does not click. And the castration joke is just, it's cheap. It's sort of beneath what I think David's
Well, it's
capable of.
also, I'm a famous actor. I am the victim of medical malpractice. My response is to fly out to New York City, stalk you, and then sneak into your apartment to murder you, right? You have a thing called a lawyer, and there are things called tort liability claims for a reason. And honestly, if you're thinking, what would an actor do? That's probably the route that all of them would go.
Well, I mean, the film hints at the fact that Danny doesn't want the news to get out because of how it would destroy his image. And I kind of get where it's coming from, particularly in the 90s. This is the sort of thing that, yeah, would have become a very cheap media punchline very quickly there and derailed any career. But the film, like, in order to be invested in that, you have to be invested in Danny as a character. And there's nothing to get invested in. He is just exists to be the butt of a punchline and to come back and give Evan a hard time later on.
Well, yeah,
Like,
he's a throwaway character until he becomes like crucial to the climax of the movie.
yeah, exactly. And that's entirely down to David's writing, in this sense. Like, you can't, like, I believe Kessler is doing the best he can with the script he has, but you can't salvage material that's not, that this does not exist on the
Yeah,
page
and
there.
for all the heights, there are like David is the one writing the jokes that land, but he's also the one writing the ones that don't. And there's a lot of this film that seems to more or less stay in very tropey territory, and it's certainly not the only film that does that, but a lot of it just isn't terribly, I guess, novel or creative. There's something that also feels very stocky about this film. And granted, that's why weird things like massage. I thought you said massage you. That's why, like, those weird lines stand out so much, because a lot of it does feel very well-worn genre setups.
Well, and that's exactly it. Like it's not that David's without talent. I really do feel, and it might even just be the case of the fact that when you're on, a show like Seinfeld and you have to work with a larger writing staff and you've got somebody like Jerry Seinfeld to sort of fire off upon, your work stuff gets workshopped a little bit more. You see where the edits need to be made, where the fixes need to be put in place. And I can imagine on a film like this where David's basically flying solo. Like, I'm looking at the producers, looking at the cast, like, there doesn't seem to be anybody who would really be in a position to push back on David and say, you need to think this through a little bit further. You need to refine this a little bit more because this just isn't clicking. Like, there needs to be that kind of balance here. And David just does not have that on this film to help get it into the shape it needs to be to hit the heights that it probably could have with just a little bit of that in its going in its favor.
Well, yeah. I guess all that to say is that some doctors are skilled enough that they can operate on your testicles and your brain. Talent is rare, combination of talent is even rarer, and talent in one area is by no means a crossover on another. And I guess if nothing else, I mean, this film in its own myriad ways reminds us that while television and film are often conflated, they're both visual media, and that they are very different, and you have to approach them very differently when you're constructing objects. And that being said, though, I guess we need to tell the audience what the next object we're constructing, because Dave, we are going to be taking a week off from the main timeline, because we are going to, be the opposite of the duo in this film and celebrate those around us with a little bit of Christmas cheer. It's the holiday episode.
Yep, exactly. So you stay tuned. You'll get the annual numbers report from me as I annually do. I think we're in for some shockers looking back over what we did this year. For once, the 80s wasn't the top one for this decade or for this
Oh
year,
wow,
rather.
we're learning and growing as people. But you know what the 1980s is going to be? The home of the first film that we are looking at in the new year. And it wouldn't be us if it didn't connect to that one, to this one, because yes, I did single out the editor of this film, whose name I totally remember just saying, Priscilla Ned Friendly. We are going to follow her to 1983, a little film called Eddie and the Cruisers. But the last time Michael Perret was on our show, it was one of the most amazing performances of all time in Streets of Fire. And I am well happy to carry on our holiday tradition of having Michael Perret on our TVs. So, I am very much looking forward to closing out another miserable year and starting a new one, on the most optimistic note possible.
Well, absolutely. Not only will Michael Perret be back, we're also going to get the returning Tom Berenger for the first time since Fear City, way back when, Abel Ferrara's film. And then we're also getting Ellen Barkin, who I believe this will mark the third time she's popped up, after being in Sea of Love and, of course, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. And I think this will be the first time Joe Pantoliano will actually be
Joey
on a film.
Pants! Oh
Yeah.
man, it's gonna be a hoot. And stay tuned. We'll also be introducing my new segment where we help tell the difference. Stay tuned for Birkin v. Burstyn.
Okay,
I
then.
thought they were the same person for the longest time. I don't know why. But hey, only one of their sons was gonna be on television. All right, Dave, in the meantime, as people count down the Christmas clock, where can they get in touch with you on social media?
You can find me at 24 Panels, where I'm always happy to have a civil conversation. What about you, Andrew? Where can people find you?
You can find me ignoring my phone while I get back into JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. I'm on Twitter at FilmStripper, or you can email the show at FilmStripsPodcast at gmail.com. As always, you can also rate and review us in iTunes or wherever you find us. 5-star reviews obviously help move us up the charts, and we love getting them. More importantly, it's where you can leave some feedback. Tell us, what do you like? What do you hate? More nasal accents? More 1990s cultural milestones? Or a whole lot less of them? All I know is that as we close out one year and approach another, David and I, all we want to do is the same thing we've always done, which is bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. And on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners at home?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
And if you're a landlord, don't go to this individual's funeral after monotony's killed them and start asking their loved ones to, look at the bill right then and there. It's just not, nice. Bye.
Somebody has to pay for the fixtures. The world still goes on, David.
Thank you.